I listen with my psychoanalytic ear for the unconscious, for defense mechanisms, affect, ego strengths, and the relationship between us. But at the UN, I specifically want to focus on my work using a psychoanalytic lens.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Vivian Pender. Dr. Pender is a clinical professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medical College and a training and supervising psychoanalyst at Columbia University Center for Psychoanalytic Training and Research. She is a trustee of the American Psychiatric Association and a special advisor to the APA on the United Nations. She is also the main representative to the UN of the International Psychoanalytic Association, the IPA. Her edited book, The Status of Women, was published by Routledge in 2016. In our talk today, Dr. Pender will describe her long-standing and devoted work at the United Nations and some of the considerable successes she's had bringing her psychoanalytic mindset to that vital work. Dr. Pender, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
When I think of the United Nations, I think of a vast bureaucracy driven by competing and conflicting national interests. And I was intrigued when I learned about your work there, because I thought to myself, what can one individual, even an individual with sophisticated analytic thinking, what could one person do in such a large institution? And then when you and I began speaking, I realized that no matter how vast the enterprise of the United Nations is, it is still made up of people. And once we're in the realm of people and personal relationships, then, so I've learned, and our listeners will be lucky to learn tonight as well, that someone with thoughtfulness and analytic sophistication can make a considerable difference, as you have over the years, though I hadn't realized it literally has been over 20 years that you've been working. Can you share with us some of the interventions that you've been able to make over the years, and some of the positive results that you've seen from this, especially in those areas that I know that are dear to you, and that is the crisis in sex trafficking and forced marriages?
Yes, thank you so much, Harvey, for inviting me to do this podcast. So I will begin with my work with the UN. When I think about it, the way I grapple with the size of the UN is that I organize it and I divide my work into three major components. That is governments, UN agencies, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations. So very often I am speaking with a person at the UN who is from a different culture, a different part of the world, and I can use my empathy to their cultural identity, that is part of my general curiosity and empathy with any human being. I listen with my psychoanalytic ear for the unconscious, for defense mechanisms, affect, ego strengths, and the relationship between us. But at the UN, I specifically want to focus on my work using a psychoanalytic lens. So my cultural sensitivity is to their work task, in addition to their ethnicity. I look at the UN as a culture in itself. I learned a lot about this through Beyond's work groups and the Tavistock model of large groups and leaders. So to oversimplify the UN, the governments make the treaties, the conventions, the resolutions. The UN agencies are the administrators, and the NGOs, that's us, are the people, or what's known as civil society. And the IPA is one of those NGOs. When I'm speaking to a government representative, I understand it as a political transaction, and I appreciate the difficulty they have of governing. And when I speak to the UN staff, knowing that they are underpaid, understaffed, and overburdened, I am supportive of their work. And when I speak with other NGOs, I try to garner their passion, their creativity, and activism to work together on a particular project. I don't use psychoanalytic jargon, but I do describe a psychoanalytic term. So, for example, I worked with an ambassador in his role as chair of the Commission on the Status of Women. It's an annual two-week conference established in 1946 and goes on every year. He was beleaguered and distressed in his task of getting the countries to agree on a UN resolution, all the while being verbally attacked by women who travel to the UN from sub-Saharan Africa. The women who had experienced untold violence at home, state-sanctioned rape, felt mistreated by the ambassador. I explained to him that they were making him feel the way they felt by putting their feelings into him. I also helped him to understand his own feelings separate from the way the women made him feel about himself and not act on them. He reconsidered expelling them from the conference. He was going to do that, but fortunately, he was relatively sophisticated and grateful for my consultation. I never used the term projective identification.
It's a lovely example.
Thank you. One of the issues that we often confront at the UN is the range and extent of violence against women and girls. The UN is a trove of data and often firsthand accounts of on-the-ground experiences. People from around the world are invited to essentially testify at the UN. And this is another feature of working at the UN that is where I witness the examples of human tragedy that occur every day. But this is similar, in my mind, to the bearing witness feature of the psychoanalytic method. Psychoanalysts in the office act as containers, as receptacles, and witnesses. One of the unthinkable and unsymbolized traumas is the commercial sexual exploitation of women and girls. It's a hidden epidemic of human suffering. There are tens of millions worldwide, mostly women and children, who are trafficked for sexual exploitation. In the U.S., there are about 100,000 reports of children beginning at the average age of 12 who are trafficked within the U.S. It includes forced early marriage. By the way, child marriage is permitted in 48 states in the U.S., something that people rarely are aware of.
I was shocked when you mentioned that.
Yes. Either with parental permission or a judge who can also grant permission. And the lower limit in most states is 14 years old, but in a handful of states, there is no lower limit. So you have to remember that at the UN, I'm dealing with governments, I'm working with them, and that includes the US government. The US mission to the UN is essentially representatives of the US government. Another intervention that I spoke with you about was the case of an 8-year-old girl in Southeast Asia about to be married to a 60-year-old man. Essentially, her parents were selling her. And I heard about this through the communication procedure that is part of the UN structure. So the communication procedure entails anyone can report something that they are distressed about or something that they feel violates their human rights. Any individual or any group can report to the UN.
And how would someone do that? How does one, if I wanted to report something to the UN, what would I do?
Well, it's actually very easy to find. Certainly online, if you Google communication procedure, UN women, I think it will immediately pop up and you'll have instructions. They also receive letters, handwritten letters sometimes about something that they want the UN to investigate. The UN does investigate all of these reports.
What happened with this 8-year-old girl? How did she come to the attention of you and the UN?
Somebody had helped her write a letter to UN Women and UNICEF, which is the children's fund, to sort of complain about what was about to happen to her. And so communication procedure is kind of a euphemism for complaint bureau or complaint procedure. So I heard about this 8-year-old girl, and I worked with the UN agencies to find her a pro bono lawyer in her area. They went to court, and the judge granted her freedom from the marriage contract based on her human rights, based on enforcement of her human rights. And we convinced her parents to let her return to school. And it maybe sounds complicated, but it really wasn't. It was just a matter of paying attention.
My reaction isn't that it's complicated, but that it's miraculous. We work for years with patients in our offices and at times see quite dramatic life-changing results. You're describing obviously nothing short of that. You're describing a life-changing impact that your dedication to the work and to such individuals was able to give her a new lease on her life.
Yes, I believe so. I think that especially, this kind of misuse of children for adult purposes and prevention of what would be child abuse was something that could be done.
Now, do you have follow-up? Do we know anything about what it was like for her in her community and in her family when she essentially rebuffed this 60-year-old man?
Well, it took some convincing of her parents to not go down that path of selling her. But I worked with NGOs who are on the ground in her region, in her community as well. And they kept in touch with her. And as far as I know, she is still in school. I mean, that's kind of one of the main successes that we have with children is to keep them in school, because the more educated they are, then the more that they know what their human rights are, they know what is permitted and not, and what tools they can use.
You know, I'm sure many people listening to this will be as shocked as I was when I first heard it about an 8-year-old girl. Let me just say that again in case people think it's a mistake. An 8-year-old girl about to be married to a 60-year-old man. And you are working with people who not only hear that kind of information on a podcast, but live and work in that environment all day, every day. And you taught me the term secondary trauma. I'm familiar with the trauma that first responders and others certainly have. That was a new term for me, and which I always enjoy learning. But can you tell us something about what your experience has been like with the on-the-ground workers who haven't had analysis, haven't developed necessarily the place that we value where we can get perspective on these affects and these upsetnesses like you can? What's been your experience of them? Have you been able to encounter them in a useful way?
Yes. So I think a good example of this would be the UN staff who are working there every day and listening to all of these tragedies and disasters that are going on. I mean, that is the work of the UN to ensure that, you know, there's peace in the world. So a few years ago, the IPA UN committee, which has been in existence since 1997, so the UN committee started to work on a protocol for UN staff who were going on missions, frequently dangerous ones. So they might be going from a desk job in New York City to get on a plane and go to a conflict area on the other side of the world. Frequently alone, they were sent.
With any kind of training that you know of?
Not much, no. Not really, other than, you know, attending conferences and understanding what the actual conflicts were. But as far as personal training, there really wasn't any. And so they were severely traumatized. A lot of the UN staff, I think, from witnessing what they have to witness and sometimes firsthand experiencing some of these situations without any training, certainly without psychoanalytic training, they are really suffering. So, I mean, they could refuse an assignment, but many of them felt it was, you know, it was their duty to go. So a bunch of psychoanalysts met every 2 weeks for 3 years with UN staff, and we did some focus groups to work on tools such as pre-screening staff for psychological disorders or substance abuse before they went, which was not taking place at all. And then while they were on mission, offering some consultation, you know, maybe done over the internet or by telephone, and then evaluating them upon return. I mean, one of the things that we heard from the focus groups is when they did return after a minimum of 2 weeks, but usually 2 to 6 months was more like it. And they would return and be expected to go right back to their desk. And the thing that they complained about the most is that no one even asked them, how did they feel? You know, no one said, how are you?
It's like the return of the Vietnam veterans all over again.
Yes.
Nobody asked what the experience was like.
Yes. So we kind of taught UN staff to have this kind of protocol, and they instituted a good deal of it.
What interests me about what you're saying, there are many things that interest me, but one of which is that I knew nothing about the IPA's activity in the UN in general. I am fairly confident that many people listening to our conversation will be in the same spot I am in, not knowing, but even more so that you're describing a very focused effort to really work with UN personnel to both brief them beforehand and debrief them afterwards. Paint a picture. How many of you are doing this? Is this all pro bono work? How often did you meet with them? What went on?
Well, on the UN committee, there were four of us. I mean, you know, we happen to live in New York City, where major UN headquarters is. So at least as far as traveling to the UN, it's not difficult. And I have to include that I find that working with the UN is the most efficient way to work with all governments, because they're all represented there. So, you know, I don't have to travel to Africa or Asia. I can speak to governments, you know, just 20 blocks away from me, and they're all there, and they are accessible. So we met the four of us met every 2 weeks for about 3 years. We would go over to the UN, meet with staff there. You know, there was medical staff, there was representatives from the security department, security forces, and some other agencies. So I would say there was a total of about 10 of us working on this, and that included four psychoanalysts.
Such a valuable contribution. You mentioned earlier the passion of the UN workers, but one can't help but notice your own. I mean, you've been doing this, like we said, for over 20 years. You do it with such heart and such dedication. Can you let us get a glimpse into you and your past and what brings you to this point in your life and this work?
Sure. When I think about it, I think what drives me is that I'm a first generation American. My parents escaped Europe, and had it not been for this country, they may not have survived. My father was a child when his entire village was burned to the ground.
Which was located where?
In Eastern Europe.
So this was before the Holocaust?
Around that time. Yes, a little bit before. So they did escape. But what has been striking to me is that I have not lived with such horrors as my parents did. And as the people I hear from at the UN, I have the privilege, as do many of us, I suspect, of being surprised that people live with such tragedy, and frequently at the hands of other people. I think those of us who have had that good fortune to live largely and in balance without such sometimes irreversible events as world wars have to respect having that privilege. And I've met many people who unfortunately are not surprised by world events and what people do to each other. Someone called it rapaciousness of people, but for whom the UN represents hope and intervention. So, you know, psychoanalysis also represents hope for relief of suffering and a better life. But one person can do a lot. And I feel that I'm one person who on my own has done a lot. But I have a lot of faith in large groups. Large groups can do so much more for so many people. I believe in the effectiveness of large institutions to do something for the greater good. And I think that is the UN. It was founded in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights after the devastation of World War II and the destruction of so many people and countries. And people wanted peace and an end to violence of that scale. And we who were born after that time are fortunate, I think, that the UN continues to do its work towards fulfilling that role to achieve peace for the benefit and progress of all of humanity. And that is their work. And it's a privilege for me to work with them.
That comes across very clearly. You know, in listening to you, I'm reminded of the journey that we take when we do clinical work on the couch, where we meet someone and there's a surface presentation of various sorts, and we have the privilege through our work to get inside that person's experience. Well, likewise, my listening to you today, I came with some image of the United Nations born from the media and the ease with which it is for all of us to be cynical. And that's sort of my glib understanding of the UN, that it's ineffective, that it's hypocritical, and that it's, you know, contradictory and all that. But through listening to you, I'm realizing that there's a whole inside world that is rich and caring and driven by commitment and passion to the well-being of people. And it's quite instructive and moving to learn about this, not to mention learning about your commitment to this work.
Well, I appreciate that. I do find it generally inspiring to see the people there and see what they do day after day. And they're mostly generally good intentions to improve people's lives. They're really dedicated to that. And so I see myself as partnering with them and consulting whenever they need consultation. I make myself available to them. And yes, it's all voluntary.
Yes, that came through as well. Right. Dr. Pender, thank you so much, not only for your work over the years and for representing psychoanalysis in the IPA, but for teaching me, and I'm sure the listeners as well, to learn about the UN and the commitment of you and people like you doing such good work. I appreciate your spending time with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.